Hello, my name is Peter. Welcome to this week's edition of Connecticut Connections, a quick review of some of this week's top news stories from around our state. Our first article was posted to the Associated Press online service on March 21st. It's written by Liz Hardaway, and it's titled, Driver in Hit and Run That Seriously Injured Connecticut Lieutenant Governor's Brother to Be Sentenced Today. A Brantford man who has pleaded guilty to a hit and run that seriously injured the lieutenant governor's brother in 2022 is expected to be sentenced on Thursday. Neil Strom, 32, has pleaded guilty to second-degree assault and evading responsibility, resulting in serious physical injury. He is released on a $100,000 bond and is scheduled to be sentenced in the state superior court in New Haven Thursday morning. The incident occurred in Guilford on the afternoon of November 12, 2022, on Route 146 or Leets Island Road. Strom was driving in the westbound lane when he crossed over the center line and into the eastbound lane, hitting bicyclist John Bisewitz, the brother of Lieutenant Governor Susan Bisewitz, according to a Guilford police report. Strom fled in his black 2018 Honda Accord, leaving John Bisewitz seriously injured. A driver stopped and found Bisewitz after seeing pieces of a bicycle and other debris on the road. Guilford Police Chief Warren Hyatt said that this Good Samaritan was probably instrumental in saving the person's life. Police received information that Strom may have been involved in the collision and later found him at his home in Brantford. He was charged that day. Before the crash, Bisewitz was an avid runner and cyclist. He has since been on a long road of recovery. He had to get his left leg amputated below his knee, and in the beginning of 2023, he was learning to walk again using a prosthetic leg. Our next article was posted to the City of Hartford online service on March 21st. It's written by John Moritz, and it's titled, Connecticut Will Not See a Push for Aid in Dying Legislation This Year. Advocates who have fought for nearly two decades to legalize medical aid in dying in Connecticut will have to wait at least another year, as lawmakers said this week they will not make a serious push to pass a bill this legislative session. That decision was confirmed on Tuesday by Progressive State Representative Josh Elliott, Democrat from Hamden, who backed several previous and unsuccessful efforts to allow doctors to prescribe life-ending medications to patients diagnosed with terminal illnesses. Elliott said he made several attempts to raise the issue again this year, only to be hampered by legislative rules limiting what kinds of bills individual members can file during the short budget adjustment session. Recognizing the difficulty of this challenge, as well as the painstaking and emotional process of having patients and their family members testify for a change in the law, Elliott said he spoke with advocates and agreed to pause their efforts until next year. There is a recognition that there is a wide berth of issues that we can be working on, and we'd like to see wins, according to Elliott. The movement to legalize aid in dying, also referred to as death with dignity by proponents, began in Connecticut in the early 1990s. For years, advocates made little headway until 2021, when they succeeded in passing a bill through the legislature's Public Health Committee. That victory proved fleeting, however, as the bill and all subsequent efforts were routed to the Judiciary Committee, where opposition to the bill has blocked its path forward. Critics argue that the delivery of the life-ending drugs amounts to a form of euthanasia and would open a door to abusers who cajole patients into taking the drug, sometimes with ulterior motives. Both the Catholic Church and disability rights groups have been among the most vocal opponents of the idea. In recent years, the Connecticut State Medical Society has adopted a position of engaged neutrality on the bill. Some opponents, including House Minority Leader Vincent Candelora, Republican from North Brantford, have argued that more input is needed from the medical fields in order to craft successful legislation. The Aid in Dying bill is anything but dignified, Candelora said. There's a lot of ugly logistics that have to be worked out. Opposition to the bill within the Judiciary Committee remains the biggest obstacle for aid in dying legislation, Elliott said, adding that the subject matter and legislative procedures mean any bill is all but assured to have to go through that committee before reaching the House or Senate floor. We're just waiting to see who is on the Judiciary Committee next year, because at this point, people's minds are already made up. The delay comes just a few months after the death of one of the state's most prominent aid in dying advocates, Linda Bluestein. who traveled to Vermont in January in order to take advantage of that state's laws allowing terminally ill patients access to life-ending drugs. Bluestein's family publicly announced her death on January 4th, several years after she was diagnosed with multiple forms of cancer. Another longtime advocate, the Weston-based actor James Naughton, said he was frustrated by the inability to rally support for legislation in the wake of Bluestein's death, and that he and others plan to spend the next year trying to sway opponents in the legislature toward their cause. Naughton's wife, Pam, died of pancreatic cancer in 2013, an event that he says triggered his activism. There are a bunch of them who are pro-choice Democrats, so the idea of a personal autonomy is something they are familiar with and okay with, but with regards to the issue of a woman's right to choose, Naughton said, but they are not with us on this issue, and there is an inconsistency there. In 2025, the legislature will convene for a longer general session, which means that individual lawmakers will have more freedom to file bills on a wide variety of topics. At that point, Elliott said that lawmakers and advocates for Aiden Dine will be prepared to mount another campaign. Our next article was posted to the City of Waterbury online service on March 20th. It's written by Alex Wood, and it's titled Stone Academy Settlement Reached. The dispute over how the state would pay partial tuition refunds to former practical nursing students at the Stone Academy has been settled, clearing the way for the former students to receive their refunds. The dispute led to a judge issuing on February 16th an emergency order temporarily blocking the refunds. The settlement eliminates the injunction, allowing the refund payments to go forward. The state will pay the refunds from an account funded by private career schools and can then seek to recover the money and related expenses from Stone Academy, according to the court documents filed by lawyers in the Attorney General's office. The temporary injunction has been sought by lawyers representing former nursing students in suits they hope will become class actions against state officials and career training specialists, the company that ran the school, its owners, and its officers. The two suits are seeking more compensation to the students than just tuition refunds. The suit against career training specialists and its owners and officers is pending in State Superior Court in Waterbury, while the lawsuit against state officials, including Timothy Larson, the Commissioner of the State Office of Higher Education, is in U.S. District Court in New Haven. In seeking the injunction in February, the former students' lawyers argued the state was asking the students to sign a waiver of rights against the state in exchange for a payment of just a small fraction of the damages they incurred. They went on to say that students suffered losses because of bad conduct by Stone Academy and by the State Office of Higher Education and Department of Public Health. In the settlement, the plaintiffs in the state court suit withdrew their motion for the temporary injunction that had blocked the refund program. The students' lawyers and the state also agreed to the wording of a Stone Academy refund calculation guide that will be distributed to former students. The students will receive funds for hours of instruction that an audit commissioned by the state concluded were not in compliance with laws and regulations, and for instructional hours that they could not complete when the school closed abruptly on February 4, 2023. The state's original version of the guide said if a student disagreed with the audit's conclusions about their refund, the student can decline to accept the refund offer. The student lawyers objected to that language, arguing it could put the former students in the position of having to accept the audit's conclusions to receive tuition refunds. The lawyers have challenged the legal propriety of the audit in the federal lawsuit. The students' lawyers suggested rewriting the guide to say that by agreeing to accept the reimbursement, the student does not waive and expressly reserves their right to challenge the propriety of the audit and any other actions taken by the state in connection with the closure of Stone Academy. In the settlement, the two sides agreed to a version of the guide that includes neither of the preferred language. The final version neither states students who disagree with the refund calculation can decline to accept the money, nor says they reserve their right to challenge the audit. Stone Academy had campuses in West Haven, East Hartford, and Waterbury, where hundreds of students were studying to become licensed practical nurses. In December, State Superior Court Judge Barbara Bellis, who was presiding over the former student's suit against the Stone Academy and its owners and officers, ordered a $5 million pre-judgment remedy against the defendants to secure payment of any eventual judgment. In the federal lawsuit, the student lawyers argued against the state's decision to have a private consultant audit the coursework of about 1,000 students who had been enrolled in Stone Academy at any time after November 1st, 2021. The audit declared invalid approximately 77,000 of 102,000 clinical and other hours that had been completed by members on the class, even though this coursework had been performed during the period that Stone Academy had a valid certification from the State Office of Higher Education. State officials had no legal basis, nor was it otherwise authorized in either statute or regulation to retroactively declare invalid credits that had been conferred upon plaintiffs by Stone Academy while the school had state authorization to operate, according to the suit. Our next article was published in the Journal Enquirer on March 20th. It's written by Susan Danzier, and it's titled, Armed Security Guards in One Connecticut School District Authorized to Use Deadly Physical Force. Officials have approved the job descriptions for armed security guards in the Enfield schools, which include using deadly physical force to protect themselves, students, and staff. Having these guards in the public schools has been met with mixed reaction in the community. Some have said the town must do everything in its power to protect whoever sets foot in the buildings, while others question if the funds going towards paying the armed school security officers could be better spent on school programs and staff, and whether the decision to employ the personnel was a decision agreed to by the Board of Education. Superintendent Christopher Drezek said during a March 12th meeting that he's 100% behind having armed personnel in the schools. While he understands some board members are not in favor of the idea, Drezek said he realizes it's a reflection of times that the district needs this level of security. The district had a similar program 9 years ago, and staff members who helped develop it at the time know how to make sure it works well, according to Drezek. Town council members on Monday voted unanimously to adopt the job descriptions for the armed school security office supervisor and school security officers. The supervisors and officials set to begin working in the 24-25 school year will report to Police Chief Alaric Fox. Now that the job descriptions have been adopted, Fox can begin recruiting for the 28 positions, according to Town Manager Christopher Bromson. State statutes describe the level of training and qualifications for the armed school security officers. The job descriptions state that officers and their supervisor must be able to meet and maintain firearm qualifications and be authorized to carry a firearm in the state and must hold all other permits, certifications, and licenses required by any applicable federal and/or Connecticut law. In addition, the personnel must meet the handgun firearms qualification standards set forth for the Enfield Police Department, subject to periodic firearms qualification. The armed school security officers will not conduct any search or seizure of property of any students or staff, take disciplinary action, or have access to student records or property of any student, according to the officials. Town council members approved the job descriptions before a memorandum of understanding between the town and school department was signed. Bronson said the MOU will be completed within roughly 1 week, and he will share it with the town council before signing it. The plan would be to have 14 officers in the schools at all times. The expected 28 officers would not work every day. What happens if we can't fill that number? Asked town council member Bob Crisati. Maybe people are looking for full-time work with benefits. Fox said the town would consider several options should that be the case, including raising the pay to attract more candidates or hiring fewer than the 28 officers who would work more hours each week. He advised that the hours not be more than 30 hours per week or the town would have to provide state-required benefits. The town at one time had armed guards in all its school buildings. The program was recommended in January 2013 by a security committee in response to the killing of 20 children and 6 staff members by a gunman at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown in December 2012. We want to know as many hurdles as we can before an armed gunman can get into the building, said former Enfield Police Chief Carl Sazavara at that time. We refuse in Enfield to accept any casualties in our schools. The program was initiated in the 2013-14 school year and continued into the 2014-15 year. It included placing armed guards at the 3 private schools in town, as well as the public schools. But in May 2015, the Board of Education voted 5-3 to end a memorandum of understanding with the town that would have continued the program for another 2 years. Later that month, town council voted 7-4 on a budget that withdrew funding for the armed guards for the public schools while still providing funding for the guards at for another 2 years in the town's three private schools, St. Martha School, St. Bernard School, and the Enfield Montessori School. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on March 19th. It's written by Don Stakem, and it's titled, Demolition Begins on the Biggest Eyesore in the Community. After more than a decade of trying to get rid of the blighted Silver Lane Plaza, East Hartford made high-powered progress on Monday morning when a Manafort Brothers excavator ripped down the portico outside the vacant Jimart grocery store. Heavy equipment over the next few weeks will tear down the entire center building at the dilapidated plaza, the end of the line for once was East Hartford's thriving retail hub. Town officials have long envisioned a redevelopment for the 22-acre site and are looking for Massachusetts-based Grossman Development Group to produce details for its proposed mix of modular homes along with new restaurants and retail. This has been a long time coming. It's an incredibly happy day when we can take down the biggest eyesore in the community, Town Council Chair Richard Kehoe said, as a small group of local politicians and business leaders gathered to watch the ceremonial start of the demolition. Mayor Connor Martin climbed into Manafort's large Volvo 380 excavator to pose for photos, then led the cheers when the machine tore down the portico just a few minutes later. East Hartford is still negotiating to move the final four tenants out of the plaza's two smaller buildings, and then will demolish those structures also. That will leave a clear field for Grossman to build on and will be the second major phase of cleanup in a part of town that's been run down for years. Just to the northeast of the plaza is the vacant Showcase Cinema site where Jasco Development and Zelman Real Estate are soon to break ground on the Concourse Park market rate apartment complex, East Hartford's biggest single residential expansion in decades. Both of these properties, Silver Lane Plaza and Showcase Cinemas, represent the rebuilding and revitalization of a vital neighborhood and commercial corridor here in East Hartford, Martin said in his brief speech. Concourse Park will be home to around 400 amenity-rich apartments, and this site that we're on right now will be mixed use with commercial, retail, and housing. Adding that his administration is asking Grossman to factor in a bigger share of retail restaurants and entertainment venues than it initially proposed. We're looking at the options they presented to us, and we're meeting on a monthly basis. I want to see a little more commercial on the site versus housing. I don't want to saturate the area too much with housing. The community has really been asking for more commercial than anything else. East Hartford, as more than 10 years ago, took the first steps toward pushing owners of the Silver Lane Plaza to either step up maintenance and improve the occupancy rate or sell the property. An out-of-state investor bought it in 2016 but never produced the turnaround that the town saw. Former Mayor Michael Walsh made the plaza project one of his top priorities after the owner ignored repeated attempts to negotiate to launch a time-consuming eminent domain action. Private market failed this community, Walsh said at the time. East Hartford prevailed and acquired the plaza for $4.5 million, which was paid through state grants. The town took title to about 110,000 square feet of mostly vacant and badly run-down commercial property and discovered that some of the remaining tenants were tiny, marginal businesses that had gotten by because the rent had been only $1 or $2 per square foot. The town pumped money into relocation grants and succeeded in moving most of the larger businesses. Jimart, an Asian grocery store, relocated to Manchester. Bare Bones Boxing moved just a mile north on Silver Lane to a newer, larger building. Some of the smaller businesses simply folded, but four, including three restaurants, remain in the plaza's two side buildings despite eviction notices from the town. Martin believes they'll be gone by June and already is seeking contractor bids to remove hazardous materials from those buildings. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on March 20th. It's written by Don Stakem, and it's titled, Future of Connecticut Park in Question After Report Says It's No Longer Suitable for Swimming. As Connecticut tries to figure out who should operate Hartford's sprawling Battersea Park, state environmental officials have issued a troubling warning. Its 160-acre pond probably won't return as a summertime swimming destination. With restoration, the park still could accommodate kayaking, boating, fishing, hiking, and other forms of recreation, but its decades-long run as a splash place to swim probably won't be revived. According to the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, or DEEP, said in a recent report, based on analysis of the available water quality data, Battersea Park Road is not suitable for swimming, according to DEEP, due to the park's location in a developed area and other challenges. Water quality improvement efforts will be expensive, take years to implement, and ultimately may not be sustainable. The future of the park that straddles the Farmington and New Britain border has been unclear for years and has been closed to the public since the City of Hartford, its owner, stopped paying for maintenance in 2015. But its supporters believe that there's a false start in 2021. Connecticut now may be on track to get the park renovated and ready to open. The General Assembly's Environment Committee wants to put maintenance under the control of Riverfront Recapture or another nonprofit and direct a stream of state revenue to pay for it, resolving the longstanding obstacle of who would take responsibility for operations. The idea has the support of House Speaker Matt Ritter, a powerful proponent of restoring Battersea Park as a recreational hub for Central Connecticut. The Environment Committee earlier this month passed a bill to have DEEP, the City of Hartford, and Riverfront Recapture negotiate an agreement, and lawmakers are awaiting a report on cost projections. Ritter said on Tuesday he's optimistic that a deal can be worked out based on raising the passport to the park's car registration fee so that all maintenance costs can be absorbed by DEEP rather than perpetually cash-strapped City of Hartford. Connecticut residents currently pay a $15 surcharge every 3 years when renewing their vehicle registrations. That provides DEEP with about $16 million a year for state park improvements. Under the Environment Committee's bill, the fee could rise by 50 cents next summer to cover. We'll have the funding mechanism resolved so that it will open up to the City of Hartford to select someone to operate it. It could be Riverfront Recapture. It could be someone else. This is a very good compromise that will get this beautiful parcel open to the public again. Battersea is problematic partly because it will be costly to restore and costly to operate, and partly because its location means it's nothing like a typical municipal park. Hartford owns the property and is responsible for its upkeep, but amid nonstop budget shortages, it chose in 2015 to simply close it. There was little or no pushback from Hartford residents because they aren't the main users. The closest part of the city is nearly 5 miles away, and a trip from Upper Albany or North Meadows section to Battersea is more than 10 miles. New Britain residents, on the other hand, used to use the park heavily, but that city doesn't have parks maintenance money to spare either, and it has the control or no control over the Battersea property. And DEEP, which is already pressured by expenses to run its inventory of state parks, has shown no interest in adding Battersea to its responsibilities. In 2021, Ritter arranged a $10 million state grant to cover repairs and renovations, and neighbors were talking excitedly about the chances for a 2023 swimming season. The plan was for Hartford, New Britain, and Farmington to work out an arrangement on paying year-to-year operating expenses, but that didn't happen. Instead, Hartford paid to dismantle decrepit and vandalized buildings, but made no other progress. Environment Committee co-chair Senator Rick Lopes, whose district includes New Britain as well as Farmington, believes the best solution is to maintain Hartford's ownership but put operations under a qualified nonprofit group. There is universal bipartisan support for making this some form of state entity and cleaning it up so it can be used by citizens of the state. We're working through those details now. Deep study suggested recreational activities at Battersea would include relatively passive uses such as environmental education programs, hiking, fishing, and bird watching. Depending on what entity runs the park, more active options could include beach volleyball, splash pads, boat rentals, disc golf, and more. Restoring the water quality to accommodate swimming, however, would be difficult at best, Deep said. Stopping stormwater runoff from I-84 would require multi-million dollar infrastructure repairs, and the pond would still be subject to the new contamination from flocks of geese as well as bacteria blooms triggered by underwater plants. It is unrealistic, especially in the short to midterm, to expect that chemical treatments, aeration, or any other quick-fix solutions would be successful at establishing water quality that is swimmable at any acceptable public health risk level. Battersea supporters said they're focused on getting the park reopened and said the state could address the issue of water quality at some point in the future. Our next article was posted to the Associated Press online service on March 20th. It's written by Julio Cortez, and it's titled, Connecticut Inn that reportedly required removal of service animals in 2023 reaches ADA settlement. A Connecticut conference center and hotel has agreed to permit service animals as part of an American with Disabilities or ADA Act settlement. The U.S. Attorney's Office announced on Tuesday that it reached a settlement agreement with the Norwalk Inn and Conference Center, located at 99 East Avenue in Norwalk, to resolve allegations that the facility was not complying with the ADA of 1990. The ADA reportedly received a complaint from an individual with disabilities alleging that the Norwalk Inn required the removal of a service animal from the inn as a condition of service in July 2023, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. As a result of the settlement agreement, the Norwalk Inn is in the process of posting signage indicating service animals are welcomed, implementing a service animal policy, which includes the type of legally permissible inquiries Norwalk Inn employees may take of a customer who enters the facility with a service animal, and in training employees regarding the policy. The U.S. Attorney's Office noted that the owners of the Norwalk Inn promptly addressed the ADA issues without litigation. According to the federal law, places of public accommodation, including hotels and restaurants, are prohibited from discriminating based on disability. The ADA authorizes the U.S. Department of Justice to investigate complaints and conduct periodic compliance reviews. The Justice Department is also authorized to commence a civil lawsuit in federal court in any case that involves a pattern or practice of discrimination or that raises issues of general public importance, and to seek injunctive relief, monetary damages, and civil penalties, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Our next article was published in the Hartford Courant on March 20th. It's written by Blaine Callahan, and it's titled, Mystic Aquarium Expands Exhibit on Offshore Wind and Research. Visitors to Mystic Aquarium will be treated to an expanded exhibit highlighting offshore wind and the aquarium's own research related to the field, according to the organization. The expansion comes in collaboration with research agencies as well as Ørsted and Eversource. Climate change is one of the biggest threats to our ocean planet, said Katie Kubina, Senior Vice President for Mission Programs, in a recent statement. Combating climate change requires transitioning fossil fuels to renewable energy sources such as wind, solar, and geothermal power. Mystic Aquarium is researching the potential impacts of offshore wind on marine ecosystems and wildlife to help inform the most responsible and sustainable development of offshore wind in our region. The aquarium said its research projects include monitoring marine mammal and sea turtle standings, developing non-invasive health assessment techniques for marine mammals, tracking rehabilitated seals and sea turtles, analyzing environmental DNA to identify which species are present near wind farms at any given time. Offshore wind is a critical solution to the existential threat and climate change poses to marine habitats and will help New England transition to clean, renewable energy sources, said Nicole Verdi, Ørsted Senior Manager of Government Affairs and Policy. The expanded exhibit features video interviews with aquarium leaders and visual assets provided by Ørsted. The Renewable Ocean Energy exhibit will also highlight a number of new and emerging technologies and applications and introduce young people to a diverse array of exciting careers in related fields through digital and hands-on interactives. Our next article was published in the Hartford Courant on March 19th. It's written by Pamela McLaughlin, and it's titled, Connecticut Pageant for Women 60 and Over Seeks Contestants. A pageant that showcases older women for their grace, talent, and inner beauty is in search for contestants. So if you're a woman at least 60 years old, the Miss Connecticut Senior America pageant is hoping you will vie for the crown, said Deborah Eccles, former title holder and president and state director of Miss Senior America Club. It's a little early, but it's very hard to find contestants, Eccles said. You don't have to be any size, height, or shape. Every senior I know has such vitality. The pageant, which Eccles stresses isn't a beauty pageant, will be held June 2nd at the Bijou Theater in Bridgeport. Eccles said, win or lose, just being a part of the pageant is great fun, full of camaraderie, friendship, and activities for all beyond the pageant itself. Eccles believes it can be difficult to find contestants because women don't know what they'll do for the talent category if they don't have an obvious stage talent, such as singing, dancing, or playing an instrument. But Eccles said she can always find a woman's talent by interviewing them, and with creativity can help them bring it to the stage. Everyone has a talent, whether it's narrative, commentary, or they wrote a book and want to read a passage. She said the oldest contender last year was 84-year-old who had a tambourine act that could knock your socks off. The winner of the Connecticut title will go on to Atlantic City to compete in the Miss Senior America contest. Connecticut's title holder can be involved in the community as they want to be or don't want, just such as making appearances at events, parades, ribbon cuttings, but there are no obligations. The winner and the others who participate in the pageant in any way also entertain at nursing homes and VA hospitals. We try to bring joy to people every year. The friendship in this sisterhood is very inviting and warm. As for those competing, 30% of the score is the interview portion, 30% talent, 20% philosophy of life, and 20% the evening gown competition, where judges are more concerned about how the woman carried themselves rather than how they look. Overall, they're looking for poise and grace, referring to it all as the age of elegance. Anyone interested can contact Eccles at 203-435-4286. Eccles, 73, a winner of pageants when she was younger, held the Miss Connecticut senior title in 2021. Her platform was resources for grandparents raising grandchildren, as she has been a guardian to her grandson, Stephen, 10 years old, since he was 2 weeks old. Eccles say they now have a few contestants, but would like around 12. For the women participating, it's something to look forward to. You need to renew your life at any stage, she said. She said women can also become honorary members if they don't want to participate in a pageant, but want to be part of the organization. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on March 19th. It's written by Ed Stenard, and it's titled, Connecticut Boy with Cancer Dies After Ambulance Ride. A 13-year-old Connecticut boy suffering from leukemia and a host of other illnesses died after he suffered cardiac arrest in an ambulance that was not equipped to care for him, a lawsuit filed by his parents claims. That was one of the missteps David Hale and Christina Bilko Hale claim led to the death of Logan Hale of Ridgefield on December 30, 2021. Their lawsuit names Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, where he was being treated for his cancer, Danbury Hospital, Nuvance Health Ambulance, Dr. Morgan Pines, Dr. Beth Natt, Dr. Craig Tenenbaum, and Lauren Smith, a physician assistant. The large number of defendants represent the complexity of the decisions that were made in the final days of Logan's life, which were laid out in the lawsuit filed in Superior Court in Bridgeport. According to his obituary, Logan was a football player and major fan of the Carolina Panthers. From the moment he picked up a football as a two-year-old, he never put it down, according to the obituary. He loved his football team and all the coaches and was always ready with encouraging words for his teammates. When he was unable to play, he would still attend practices and games to show his team support. Logan, an eighth grader at the East Ridge Middle School, was also a black belt in Taekwondo, loved to skateboard and scooter, played basketball and lacrosse, and acting in independent films and commercials. Besides his parents, he leaves a brother, Ethan Hale. According to the lawsuit, Logan woke up with abdominal pain on December 25, 2021, the day before his 13th birthday. His parent called Pines, the on-call physician at Memorial Sloan, who determined Logan had an inflammation of the small intestine and prescribed Tylenol. He determined Logan did not need to come to the hospital. Later, Logan's condition worsened, and he was taken to Danbury Hospital with shortness of breath, rapid and shallow breathing, hypoxia, cyanosis, abnormal and rapid heartbeat, and fever. It was determined he had lower than normal number of white and red blood cells. Tenenbaum diagnosed neutropenic fever and sepsis. Tenenbaum then sought a consultation with Nat, according to the lawsuit, who directed Smith to do so. Smith found a number of symptoms, including fever, spots on skin, shortness of breath, sepsis, chills, rigors, worsening tachycardia, and blood pressure between 180 and 190. The doctors then made a plan to transport Logan to Memorial Sloan, but were told only basic life support ambulances were available. The defendants were aware that Logan's condition had deteriorated since his arrival at the defendant Danbury Hospital, that he was not stable for transport to the defendant MSK site, that a basic life support ambulance did not have proper and effective monitoring equipment, and the EMTs operating the new Vance ambulance were not trained nor capable of providing proper care, treatment and monitoring, nor effective airway management and intubations. It continues that the defendants were aware that transporting Logan put him at risk for further deterioration and death. Logan was put in the new Vance ambulance staffed by two EMTs, but on the way he suffered a cardiac arrest, according to the complaint, stopped breathing, became unconscious. The EMTs made multiple attempts to intubate Logan. Logan was transferred to an Empress ambulance and taken to White Plains Hospital, which was closer than Memorial Sloan. He was unresponsive on arrival, so he was taken to the pediatric intensive care at Westchester Medical Center in Valhalla, New York. There, Logan was found to be status post-cardiac arrest with multiple organ dysfunction and encephalitic with no eye movement. In an immunocompromised state, he was diagnosed with severe sepsis with septic shock. An abdominal CT scan found an inflammation of Logan's intestine. A CT scan of the brain found him to be brain dead with hypoxic, ischemic, encephalopathic, and cerebral edema. His parents decided to discontinue life support on December 30th, 5 days after Logan's 13th birthday. The Hales are accusing the defendants of negligence in the decisions that led to Logan's death and in permitting him to be transferred from Danbury Hospital to Memorial Sloan Kettering. New Vance Health and Memorial Sloan Kettering did not respond to requests for comment on this story. Danbury Hospital is part of New Vance Health. The Hales are represented by Patrick Filan of Fairfield. Our next article was posted to the City of Hartford online service on March 19th. It's written by Ken Dixon, and it's titled, After Death of Nurses, Connecticut Lawmakers Look for Solutions. Home health agencies would have to find out more background information about their patients and would be reimbursed for providing visiting nurses with escorts to certain homes and neighborhoods under legislation pushed Monday by Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney. The bill, which is a top priority for Looney's majority caucus, would require home health care companies to provide more safety training and ways to perform safety checks on cell phone apps. It would be mandatory for agencies and staff, including nurses and aides, to create risk assessments of individual patients and report threats or abuse. It was inspired in part by the murder last year of Joyce Grayson of Brooklyn, Connecticut, who was killed in a halfway house for sex offenders in Willimantic, as well as the January death of Otagil Murulan, a living caregiver and citizen of the Republican of Botswana, who died in an East Hartford house fire. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, healthcare workers are five times more likely to experience violence compared to people working in other sectors. We just cannot ignore that risk. Looney noted that other survey of nurses from 2022 reported that 60% of those who responded had experienced violence, bullying, or incivility on the job. Under the legislation, which is, if approved, in committee would next head to the Senate floor, there would be a $1 million program established in the State Department of Public Health to help purchase safety technology for the agencies. Agencies would have to research patients, families, others, in their homes, as well as the neighbors that nurses visit, an attempt to grade potential physical threats to the health professionals. It would also provide some funding to help those who believe that hiring escorts would be necessary in certain circumstances for their employees. We've been waiting a long time to be the important people that deserve a state safe work environment, said first-term Senator Martha Marks, Democrat from New London, a registered nurse and longtime visiting nurse who knew Moraline. I think it's going to be hard for people to understand that when we go to somebody's home to care for them, that it might be their home, but it's our workplace. We deserve to feel safe. She said that the fact that the Federal Occupational Safe and Healthy Administration was not called to probe the circumstances around Moraline's death is typical of the lack of respect that home care workers get. were pretty low on the food chain, she said. He was an amazing and kind man. She asked Looney whether the bill, if it became law, would have help working conditions actually be improved. And Looney's response was, "We are going to have to pay increasing attention to the safety of home health care workers, visiting nurses, and others just because of the demographic change in our society. More and more people are going to need those services. As we know, people are desperately anxious to stay out of nursing homes, so people infinitely prefer being cared for at their house. The oldest members of the baby boom generation are going to be 78 this year, the youngest members 60. The bill also addresses issues of cybersecurity. Attorney General William Tong said the bill would require the State Department of Public Health to join the state's cybersecurity preparedness plan. We're in a brave new world, and every day all of us are under attack. This building, your email, my email, by scammers and bad actors who want to penetrate our cybersecurity defenses and gain access to personal information." Our next article was published in the Journal Inquirer on March 19th. It's written by Alex Wood, and it's titled, "Former South Windsor Woman Awarded $20,000 in Settlement." A South Windsor woman who was once ordered to pay the town a $125,000 fine and some $52,000 in legal fees for violating zoning rules by operating a salvage business on her Miller Road property instead ended up collecting $20,000 from the town due to a contempt of a court ruling. The settlement, largely completed with payments late last month, ends close to a decade of controversy between the woman, Kristen Norton, who was formerly known by the married name Christian Lanata, and the town over the condition of her former property on Miller Road. Attorney Richard Carella, who represented the town in the case, could not be reached for comment. Photographs taken over the years show that the lower level of the raised ranch house that once stood on the property was jammed with personal items, and the yard was heavily strewn with debris. Neighbors and town officials maintained that it was a blight on the neighborhood. The house was severely damaged on a fire, December 6, 2016, but there continued to be controversy over Norton's use of the property in her salvage business in the years afterward. The town sued Norton in 2017 in State Superior Court in Hartford, alleging violations of zoning and blight conditions. The case was sent to trial in 2019, leading to a decision by Judge Thomas Mukosher ordering Norton to pay the town $125,000 for zoning violations, plus the town's legal expenses totaling more than $52,000. But Norton appealed, and the state appellate court reversed the judge's decision in 2021, concluding Mukosher had made two errors that resulted in the fine being higher than the law allowed. Meanwhile, Norton and her lawyer, Edward Timon, had taken the offensive in U.S. bankruptcy court, arguing that the town and two officials had violated a court order by trying to collect $26,000 in cleanup costs. Bankruptcy Judge James Tancredi agreed and held the town and the officials in civil contempt of court for the debt collection effort, but he refused to take steps that could have led to criminal contempt proceedings, concluding the officials had not acted maliciously or in bad faith. Still, Tancredi ordered the town to pay Norton $20,000 to compensate for the emotional distress caused by the improper debt collection effort, as well as about $100,000 in legal fees. That decision appears to have been the key to the settlement of the case. Timon said it turned the corner on a lot of this. The town paid $120,000 into a bankruptcy court account. Timon said the settlement involved the state zoning and the bankruptcy cases. He said his client received $20,000 the bankruptcy judge awarded to her, plus interest. The town got back $30,000 as a fine for zoning violations, and Taman got $70,000 plus interest for his legal work. Taman said he agreed to have the $30,000 fine taken out of the roughly $100,000 the bankruptcy judge had awarded him for his fee. A state judge approved a joint motion by the two sides to adopt the settlement, which says the in part of the previous state court judgment ordering Norton to pay the town's legal fees shall be vacated. After 8 years of litigation, everyone just wanted to move on, Taman said. The town has been held accountable for some of the actions. We have no beef with them at this point. Norton now lives in Florida and still has her business cleaning up foreclosed properties for banks and other financial institutions, according to Timon. Our next article was posted to the City of Bridgeport online service on March 19. It's written by Daniel Tepfer, and it's titled, Stanford Official Claims Wilted Eye Surgeon Permanently Damaged His Vision. Stanford's chief information officer had hoped to begin a second career as a flight instructor after he retired, but alleges in a lawsuit that those hopes vanished when a routine eye surgery severely damaged his vision. Isidore Sablowski, 67 years old, claims in a lawsuit filed in State Superior Court in Bridgeport that doctors at the Wilton Surgery Center failed to properly clean their instruments, resulting in him contracting a slight threatening eye infection. The Stanford resident is seeking unspecified damages against the surgery center and their ophthalmologist, Dr. Glenn Ostriker. Ostriker, a Greenwich resident, also serves as the director of ophthalmology at Stanford Hospital, which is also named in the suit. I envision a whole life for myself in retirement, filled with playing with my grandkids, pursuing my lifelong passion of piloting planes, and spending time with my wife, Fran, Sablowski said in a written statement. The defendants shattered this dream when they failed to sterilize the instruments during my routine cataract surgery, leading to a near-fatal infection and ultimately blindness in my eye. Accountability is needed to ensure this never happens again to another family. The lawyer for Stanford Health, Eric Stockman of Stockman O'Connor and Connors, said, as of this matter is the subject of pending litigation, Stanford Health will express its views and defend itself through the judicial process. Lawyers for the surgery center and the doctor did not return emails and calls for comment. Sapkowski's wife, Fran Tischler, is co-plaintiff in the case. Izzy and his wife, Fran, have had their lives completely upended by the defendant's negligence, said their lawyer, Douglas Morbito, of the Bridgeport law firm Kostoff, Kostoff & Biter. Izzy came in for a routine cataract procedure and was left with irreparable damage to his eye, deeply compromising his quality of life along with his family's. This lawsuit is seeking justice for Izzy and Fran for what was plainly a preventable error. Sabalowski, a nationally recognized expert in artificial intelligence, was appointed Stanford's first chief information officer in 2021. According to the suit, on May 24, 2022, Sablowski went to the Wilton Surgery Center for cataract surgery. But the very cataract surgery that was supposed to extend Izzy's horizons instead left his future plans permanently grounded. The lawsuit claims that the center's medical staff and Ostriker did not adequately and properly clean and sterilize the surgical equipment used during the surgery, resulting in Sablowski's contracting a bacterial infection in his eye. The lawsuit claims that Sablowski was not the only patient treated at the Wilton Surgery Center that day to experience vision loss following a scheduled surgery. According to the lawsuit, at least one additional patient was blinded after also developing an infection. As a result of his condition, Sablowski now suffers from permanent and severe vision loss punctuated by uncontrollable eye tearing and severe light sensitivity. Ostriker has asked the court to dismiss the case, claiming Sabalowski and Tischler failed to include a sufficient written expert opinion letter authored by a similar healthcare provider. As of Monday, the judge had not ruled on that motion. Our next article was posted to the Associated Press online service on March 19th. It's written by Luther Termel, and it's titled, Connecticut Ranked Fifth in Home Foreclosure Activity in February. Connecticut had the fifth highest home foreclosure rates in the country in February, according to a new report from the real estate data firm ATOM. The state's foreclosure rate last month was one in every 2,800 housing units, according to the report. South Carolina had the highest foreclosure rate of one in every 2,200 units. Nationwide, one in every 4,300 housing units had a foreclosure filing in February 2024. For the purposes of the ATOM report, foreclosure filings include default notices, scheduled auctions, and bank repossessions. Nationwide, there were a total of 33,000 U.S. properties with foreclosure filings last month, an increase of 8% from February 2023. Rob Barber, Adams' chief executive officer, said the increase in foreclosure activity hints at shifting dynamics within the housing market. These trends could signify evolving financial landscapes for homeowners, prompting adjustments in market strategies and lending practices. There are currently 86 foreclosed homes currently for sale in Connecticut, according to the real estate website Zillow. Municipalities have another 251 homes scheduled for foreclosure sales, according to data from the state's judicial branch. The three communities with the largest number of foreclosure sales listed on Monday were Bridgeport with 19, Hartford with 12, and Middletown with 10. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on March 18th. It's written by Ken Goslin, and it's titled, Pharmacy Giant Will Lay Off Hundreds of People in Connecticut. Pharmacy giant Walgreens Company will close a distribution center in Killingly later this week, laying off hundreds of employees, according to a notice filed with the State Labor Department. Walgreens will lay off 322 employees at the distribution center in the Dayville section beginning May 17th, according to a WAR notice filed with the state on March 14th. The Killingly Distribution Center is one of two being eliminated in the United States, as the drugstore chain said it seeks to streamline capacities to best support our stores. The other distribution center being shuttered is in Orlando, Florida. A total of 646 jobs are being eliminated, according to the statement. We are focused on aligning our operational structure to best serve our patients and customers. Walgreens has about 100 locations in Connecticut. Walgreens couldn't immediately provide a count of employees, and Walgreens said the layoffs are expected to be permanent. The pharmacy chain said employees losing their jobs will be given the chance to participate in the on-site career fairs and outplacement services to help find new employment. Workers losing their jobs also can apply for other open positions within the company. Our next article was posted to the Town of Portland online service on March 18th. It's written by Cassandra Day, and it's titled, Connecticut Couple Who Tended Portland Quarry Selling Land for Nordic Spa. The Portland couple who lovingly restored the grounds of a six-acre former brownstone quarry that dates back hundreds of years is selling the grounds to a Canadian-based hotel firm that plans to transform the property into a Nordic spa. 5 years ago, Darlene Rice and Dean Soucy bought Quarry View Historic Park at 311 Brownstone Avenue in Portland. They've hosted drum circles that have attracted over 300 attendees, weddings, and other functions. Pomeroy Lodging of Alberta, Canada, a family company, will be the new owners. It plans to build a year-round wellness center on the site, according to the February Planning and Zoning Commission meeting minutes. Nordic spas, popular in Scandinavia countries, are said to provide health benefits through water therapy that alternates between cold plunges and hot baths. Rice and Soucy put their heart and soul into the land, according to Rice. The best way to describe what motivated us is this was the only way we could see the future of the quarry while we were still alive, said Soucy, who quit his job the day after they walked on the land. They spent a great deal of time caring for the property. I truly believe that the quarry has given everything to us as we did for it. I never knew day to day what to expect, but a sign would pop up and we would follow it. The town has a rich history of brownstone quarrying. Portland supplied the sandstone for building projects from New York to Boston to San Francisco in the 1850s, employing over 1,500 people, according to the town website. More than 25 ships transported the stone to major population centers in the United States, Canada, and England. When the couple first walked the land, it was a tangle of brush, poison ivy, and other vegetation. They found myriad treasures such as 100-year-old tools and footings to a steam-powered winch that pulled giant pieces of stone up from the quarry. Among the discoveries have been dinosaur prints and carvings on the quarry walls, which date back to 1887. Some time ago, they advertised the property for sale. After reviewing a couple of proposals, Soucy and Rice weren't keen on the plans. A year and a half ago, their realtor told them about a prospective buyer who was excited to check the place out. That summer, a company representative gave a presentation at a town meeting. Soucy often gets choked up talking about the land, his wife said. We've put everything we've had into that quarry without the help of anyone else. When you go to Quarry Drive, there's a feeling of contentment and peace, and Dean helped create that. From the first day visitors entered the site, Susie said they talked about the positive atmosphere. To have people walk away crying after a drum circle because they were moved or someone was healed because of that feeling that they got there, this is something you can't buy. Belonging is one of the biggest things people feel down here. We truly feel that this will give an opportunity for thousands to come, and I believe that whatever they design, the same vibe will come out. A significant increase in traffic in the surrounding area is not expected, according to the presentation before the zoning board. Data shows that Friday would be the busiest weekday and Saturday the busiest day overall, with about 100 clients during peak hours. The spa is expected to incorporate the environment, include a two-story bathhouse, bistro, outdoor patio, heated pedestrian walkways, steam rooms, salt hydrotherapy, a pool, fire pits, barrel saunas, and much more. There would be no overnight accommodations. Landscaping would be in keeping with the setting, including flower beds, trees. Invasive species on the parcel, such as burning bush, would be researched. Rice will mostly miss the 13-inch quah, a carp they put in the pond some 4 years ago. Of all the fish we've had in there that could be camouflaged, he's not. He's a white fish in a brown pond. In early summer, the quah emerges from under a rock and stays around through the winter. The couple named him Ghost. I will miss him in the peace and quiet that comes along and the water flow in the quarry. It won't be easy to leave. We've had a bittersweet feeling about letting it go, but it's our time to let go. It's time for someone else to carry it forward. Our next article was published in the Journal Enquirer on March 18th. It's written by Susan Denzer, and it's titled, Connecticut Convent Finds Support from Residents. Enfield residents are largely positive about affordable rental apartments for older adults coming to the Felician Sisters property, saying many people in their 60s and older want to continue living in their town in homes for which they have the financial means. The Felician Sisters have run the Our Lady of Angels Convent and its surrounding buildings on a nearly 30-acre campus at 1315 Enfield Street since 1932. At one time, there were hundreds of nuns living on the property, but numbers have dwindled to about 23 today. As a way to have the campus live on for the community, the sisters are working with their partner, the nonprofit Boston-based Community Builders, on proposed affordable housing units for older adults. The project is supported by a $10 million grant awarded to the Community Builders in 2023 by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development Office of Multifamily Housing Programs. The funding from HUD will support the reuse of the vacant St. Felix Center on the campus into 45 units with 41 one-bedroom units and four studios, according to Bridget Armstrong, Vice President of Special Projects for Felician Sisters of North America. She appeared with Carl Landolina, attorney for the Felician Sisters, at a Planning and Zoning Commission public hearing on Tuesday to request a text amendment to the town's zoning laws for a special permit that would allow for senior housing on the convent campus. The proposed rental units meet grant requirements that housing is rented out at less than 50% of the area median income. HUD gave three grants to Connecticut Projects. Several people who spoke at the public hearing said they are already highly in favor of the proposal. This is the best presentation about housing in my neighborhood that I've heard, said Christina Lang. In fact, it was so well done that I might apply to be on the waiting list too. Many baby boomers, such as herself, want to stay in Enfield. This is timely and has funding. 17% of Enfield's population is 60 years older, and there's a lot of demand in town for this type of affordable housing. That's all for this week's Connecticut Connections. If you have any questions about the articles read today or other programs at Chris, please call the Chris Lister line at 860-727-9579. This is Peter. So long till next time.